Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At Chumba Casino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dree.
All right, we got stuff to talk about in the Nancy Guthrie case. Some new interesting things have taken place. The opening hours of this case are the ones that stretch where the facts are actually locked, not theories, not leaks, but machine timestamps and a 911 log that is now out there. A camera goes dark at 1:47 in the morning. A pacemaker loses its signal at 2:28. Later that day, after a call that Nancy had missed church, family walks into her home and is on the phone with 911 within 7 minutes. What those first hours now show us, what the records prove, what's still being kept from the public, and what a fast by-the-book start says about a case that's frozen ever since is worth slowing all the way down on. And that's what we're going to be doing today. Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, joining myself, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Jen, let's start with what we know about the time. The family, the record puts them in the house at 11:56. They're on the phone with 911 by 12:03. So they get in. Where's mom? Let's look around. I mean, it's a very reasonable, oh God, what the hell's going on? Just within 10 minutes about of them calling 911 once they get to the house. When you're looking at this from an investigative standpoint, what does it tell you about the speed of the call? What kind of a tell is that about that family that's in distress knowing mom is not there?
Well, it tells me that I believe they went in through the garage because that's how they let her in, and it seemed like that was their usual pattern. They went in, and again, mom, where are you? Mom, got the call. You look around, and these grounds are not easy. This is not just a three-bedroom, two-bath ranch. This is a larger, spread-out house on a large property. So from there, you're going to always go in and check her guest house just in case she went in there, heard something, had to get something out of there. Obviously, you're looking in the pool and you're looking at all grounds. And when you look at this time frame, that pretty much sets up about 7 minutes likely to accomplish all of that. And to me, when they then went out that front door and looked from the front door vantage and saw the blood, 911, oh my God, she's gone.
Yeah, I mean, that's the moment that I'm sure their hearts probably sunk. I mean, at first, I imagine anything could be going through your head. You know, did she get picked up somewhere? Did she go for a walk? She couldn't go for a walk. Her cane's right here. All these things running through their minds in that sheer moment of panic. And then they see the blood on that porch. The 911 call is the one that started everything. And all of this time later, the public still hasn't heard a second of the 911 call yet. It's being held back, they say, for the investigation itself. But you've been on the inside of calls like that. When the recording that kicked off this whole case still stays locked up for this long and we still don't have her, well, I guess what's being protected? Why can't we hear the 911 call?
They're always going to protect that call in a case like this. And they did the same thing in the Idaho 4 case. We never heard that call until well into the adjudication of that case. True. So they're going to follow that. There's no reason. The public doesn't need to know. The clues with the torch by spruce and if a vehicle, that's what the public can help with. They're not going to release anything unless the public can provide help. Other than that, they don't care that the public does or doesn't.
Yeah, I'm really curious about the 911 call, Jen, because only when we started looking at this, like, oh my gosh, we haven't had the 911 call, especially since 911 calls, as you know, are so telling, because you can really predict whether someone has involvement or not involvement a lot of times, not all times, but a lot of times from a 911 call. I would think if they're looking to clear family and show how they're not involved, just how they make that 911 call could really dispel a lot of those conspiracy theories on it, I would think. Any thoughts on that?
So I find it interesting, Robin, that in so many cases, no matter what the person says on the 911 call, it's going to be scrutinized. If they're panic and go crazy, they say, oh my gosh, it's an act. If they are calm, they say, see, they don't even care that she's missing. So to me, there's no upside if I'm an investigator to release the call, because I think it makes the dogs come out against the family no matter what was said, especially when the dogs were already released on the family.
And unless you actually know 911 calls and you can see it really readily, and to help tamp those people down. I mean, the 911. So when I worked at Quantico, we had an amazing woman. I don't know if you remember Sue Adams. She used to teach at Quantico at the FBI Academy a lot for many years. She did a great research study with another law enforcement professional years ago, and they actually did the research on it, and they came up with a formula on 911 calls. I think that had about 90% accuracy being able to tell whether the call was actually the perpetrator of the crime themselves. So there's a lot of studies from the statement analysis. I know it doesn't help the general public at large, but hopefully maybe that's part of the see, that's why it would have helped if Nano said something to the effect of, we analyzed the 911 call. The BAU analyzed the 911 call. That was part of our way that we got rid of the family as suspects, rather than just say, no, they're not considered anymore.
Yeah, no, they could have listed so many things. For instance, the poll results. They could have talked about the digital trail. They could have talked about all the car information that disclosed that, listen, every Saturday night they go back and forth this way. Uber's called and then, you know, he drops her off. They could have done so much. But I think, you know how law enforcement is. They're going to say the bare minimum they can to get the point across, and they're not going to give up much about what they did or didn't do.
It's not too late. Why don't they do it now?
Yeah, no kidding.
It would help Nanos. But Nanos is being quiet, right? I think Nanos has like learned his lesson. Somebody's gotten through to him. Just shut up. You know, he finally is in the clear, if you will. Nobody can get rid of him. I don't think the recall vote, that's the only thing left outstanding. And I don't think that's going to work. So he's kind of in the clear. So he's gone turtle. You know?
I mean, I'm wondering about, you know, because of, you know, the dogs that were unleashed on the family immediately. And then Nanos, a little while after, makes it somewhat generic. And look, I'm stating this as I don't believe the family's involved, but I'm stating this in a perspective of, okay, he makes his statement of they're cleared as generically as he does. And that almost like further enrages the conspiracy theories out there. Why not come out and say, okay, yeah, I gave you the generic version, but here's why I've cleared them. This, and this. This is the evidence. We have it now. I should have released it earlier. I did not. It helps him. It clears up his shortcomings, and it helps the family. If they have absolutely nothing here to hide, and I don't think they do, it further solidifies their story as well and their alibi. I guess why not at this point come out with more solid, you know, evidence-based decision-making background on some of these, you know, words that he's thrown into the ether? If they're there, why are they there? I believe there's probably a reason for it, but why not shut down the noise, I guess, at this point? Or do they just not care about the noise? Because I know the family certainly cares about the noise around this.
I think because it'll cause more noise. It's opening Pandora's box.
Yeah.
So they polygraph. Okay, now we want to see them. When were they polygraphed?
Yeah.
What happened? Polygraph. Okay, let's see the digital evidence. You've already disclosed that it's there. So what's it going to hurt to let us know about it? So I think it just opens Pandora's box, and that's why they're not going to touch it.
Makes sense.
I get that. It's a shame, you know, but there are a lot of, you know, I mean, we're critical thinkers on our show. It would help the critical thinkers that have actually critically thought through the family not being involved. It would help tamp down the nutters, because you're always going to have nutters. There's always going to be people that are conspiracy theorists. And without a little bit, granted, I'm not arguing it because I totally get it. It opens up Pandora's box again, but then it gets more attention on the case again. And then you have critical thinking people out here that are saying, hey, look, because boom, 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 look over here, here, here. I don't know.
True. Yeah. I mean, it's a battle of feelings at this point, but there's obviously some, you know, real repercussions for how things were handled early on in this. And I'm not just speaking from the Nano standpoint. The night itself left a trail. Her camera dies at 147, motion trips at 212. Her pacemaker drops off at 228. These are actual timestamps that we now have. When you line those three up in that order, Jen, I mean, what stands out to you? Is there anything chilling about the way that lays out? How does that read to you?
Well, a couple of things. One of the things is, let's start with the 212 in the middle. At the 212, where a person is seen, right? They can't make anything out, but they believe it's a person. And remember, that's another one of the spontaneous utterances of Nano's, right? Mm-hmm. He says, and he's like, oh, or it could be a pig or whatever, an animal. I think he says something like that. But yeah. I mean, clearly a person. And or else that wouldn't be on the timeline. And he wouldn't have made the spontaneous utterance. Anyway, so now we're at 212. Mope, porch guy, is not in any hurry that we've seen on camera. And I wouldn't believe that behavior would suddenly change at 212. So now he meanders over to the back. And now he's got to open a door. So he's got to breach the door. We still don't know for sure whether a door was left open or whether it wasn't. But nevertheless, let's just say he has to breach it. If he has to breach it, that takes some time. I think I can breach a door that doesn't have a deadlock in probably under 2 minutes. So let's just say that he knows how to do that. He does it under 2 minutes. If it's a deadbolt, that's even more difficult. But now he's got the door breach. He gets it. That's a period of time. And there's only from 212 to 228 with the disconnection. Then he has to go in. And if he has studied her layout of her house, he could go pretty quickly there and make the assumption she's in the bedroom. Then he has to grab her, get her. I think that there is some violence used. And I say that because I truly believe that blood is expirated on the porch, which is typically a sign of internal bleeding. Uh-huh. And so I think he probably violently grabs her. And for somebody who is as frail as she is on blood thinners, I think that that probably caused some damage. And he grabs her. I think he puts her over the shoulder or in this stance where her head is a little bit closer to the ground. Uh-huh. And grabs her. Remember, she's over 150 pounds.
Yeah.
This is not an easy task if it's just him. The door, he has already got the camera off. He opens it from the inside, walks out with her. And that time frame pretty much comports.
So we're talking, I mean, how long are we talking here in terms of minutes of them getting into the house and getting her out when we're looking at this data that now is out there? What are we at?
16 minutes from the time. He is seen on the side of the house. Remember, porch guy in an injury. He mopes over there, goes to the back, looks around. I think I'll go in this door. For some reason, he props open the doors. I don't think those were propped up. And I know some people said, well, maybe she liked a breeze. My problem with that is she knows there's javelinas out there and wildlife. I mean, that's why she got the cameras.
A thought process might be too, like, I'm going to have to carry her, prop it open so it's open, but then go get her, then just don't shut the door when you leave. I don't know. I mean, that might be part of the thought process. Robin, what are your thoughts?
I'm just still thinking about trying to sling her over my shoulder with a backpack on at 150 pounds. That's, you know, I'm just thinking about the awkwardness of trying to do that. Like you're saying, Jen, or was he carrying in front of her and carrying 150 pounds like a sack? That's a large feat. I mean, that's a huge feat. I don't know how the guy kind of going to the point where a lot of people are saying this is well planned out because he's still at large. Yeah, kind of. But like this looks like if he's targeting her, getting her out of there was a real fatal flaw in how he's going to execute that. Like you said, I agree. I think he probably grabbed her quickly once they encountered each other. Her being frail, but frail at 150. I mean, that's with again that because again, think about this. That hefty backpack he on really jutted out from his back, and you're trying to get something over your shoulder, so she's not going to be draping down the back of his back. She's going to be sliding forward. I'm getting again. You're just kind of putting yourself in that situation. That's a hard carry.
Was that part of? I guess we got to go back to then. Was taking Nancy the intent, or was Nancy being taken like an oh shit moment of? Now I got to carry her out of here because she's part of the evidence because I got my DNA on her from whatever it may be, scratching or whatever. I don't know. I mean, because again, if you're thinking he's going into this to steal or to do something of that nature, he looks equipped for that. He doesn't necessarily look like he's equipped and ready to haul somebody out. That doesn't, I don't know that
unless
he'd go
wants
in.
To walk out.
Yeah, go into there with, I don't know. I've never done this. You guys have far more experience in worlds of this nature than me. But I don't know. It doesn't, I agree. It doesn't necessarily look like that was part of the plan. But again, nothing's necessarily stolen either, other than Nancy. So we're back at square one. What was the intent you're going in? Knowing what we see of this timeline, knowing how short this was, about 16 minutes or so from start to finish. Jen, where are you at this week with it? Do you think the intent was a wrench attack or just an intent to take Nancy, period? Or does this lean more into a surprise and they took Nancy out because, you know, she was basically part of the evidence?
I've been square for months on this. This yep. was a ransom gone bad. That's it. Now, as far as who's pulling the strings on it, yeah. I'm definitely leaning toward a more organized wrench type attack in this type of a deal. But I have believed from the onset, no thief, not one thief I know goes in with a backpack like that. That's what you take empty to fill up with all the things you're going to steal. You ransack the place. You typically have more than one person. You don't this obscure place. I have never believed, not at one moment, that this was a home invasion or some thieves that it all went south. Never believed that personally. I've always said the abduction was the point. And when they go in there and take her, I agree with Robin also based on the blood spatter. If she is slung over the shoulder, I think the mist and the spatter that would have come out from where she was bleeding, you would see those pockets of emptiness on the blood that drops. And you don't see that. You also don't see footprints is why I think he did it solo. I don't think there were two people, at least at this point of it, because I think you would see footprints. And you would see that blood smudged and messed up. And that's why I think the family didn't go in the front. Because if you were going in the front, how often do you really look down?
Yeah.
You would have just walked up there in a hurry, but their modus operandi is always to go to that garage, seemingly, right? That's how she got in the night before. So I think that was the oh crap moment. And I really believe, and this is how I've described it from the beginning, that it wasn't a fireman's carry. It was more of a cradled carry. And you're right, Robin, he had to have tips for that.
So let's go down the road of your theory of targeted either by a group or organization or him as an individual. In either event, because of the way he prepped himself, if he's solo in there, which it looks like we're agreeing he is solo in there, the intent was not to incapacitate her 100% because he wasn't prepared for incapacitation. He wasn't equipped for it. And if a group organization was behind this, they have reps in this. If this is something he's been doing before and it's a wrench attack, they have reps in this. And the reps would say, if your intent was to carry her out of there incapacitated, this is not the way it would have looked. So I definitely think that if that was the intent, the intent was to remove her from the house under her own motor skills, not to have to carry her out, because it makes no sense about how they did it whatsoever. Someone that had at least done it once before where they incapacitated the victim would not have done it that way.
I agree. And I also believe that these wrench, and we'll just keep going with that theory, meaning somebody organized that's making these decisions that initially targeted her and then got somebody to do this through payment, which is our Moat Porch guy. If that is the premise, these individuals are not, this could have been, and I think it was likely his first rodeo. You know, mm-hmm. he's on the dark web getting picked out and he wants to do it. He wants the money. He wants to be Rambo for a night. And it doesn't mean that he's good at what he's done, because you're right. He doesn't have the reps. He can't even figure out how to pull off the ring camera because his gloves are five sizes too big. You know, and then he has to get that and grip it and take both hands and you know, get that plant matter deposited deep into the holder.
Yeah.
So it was just waving it. A lot of people, again, that, you know, I know it's psychobabble that, you know, the ivy, like it meant something. I just don't think that's the case here. I think it was purposeful.
I don't see a world where the plant matter was pre-planned. Like, oh yeah, just go grab some plants and that'll work out great for whatever. It's like, yeah, that seemed to be a desperate move of they'll get some traction using this. Okay, do that. It doesn't seem to be the work of a super experienced. But and that's the weird thing with these wrench attacks is I've studied up on them too this week. It essentially doesn't matter. You know, who your idiots are, your mopes are that you're using. Because if it all goes to hell, it's not going to be traced back to you anyhow. And you can just try it with another person next time. And there's a first time for everything for folks who want to sign up for missions like this. And again, this might be the first time for this guy. And this is what you got.
He was pretty fluid for a first time, though. So it might have been a first. So again, going down Jen's theory, if he's hired by someone as a mope, it wasn't his first time doing a B&E because he was fluid. That might have been his first attempt at this. Then it goes back to my question for you, Jen. So if the intent, if we're looking at behaviorally, we're looking at intent for a wrench attack, she's got to be alive, got to be conscious. And he wasn't prepared to have to be carrying her out. So her being incapacitated was not part of the plan. So then why remove her and not leave her?
Oh, I totally agree. But I don't think necessarily, she wasn't dead and he would have known that.
Right, right.
If she were dead, she couldn't expirate. So just because somebody isn't mobile enough, like you need them to be, the cane was left behind. We know that now for certain. I don't think she walked out on her own accord.
Definitely not.
Recently, though, a crime scene reconstructionist type person, they said she did and that she was actually like crawling and was that close to the ground. I just don't believe that. I think he was like, we're getting out of here, grandma. I think it's likely she could have even been unconscious and that wasn't expected. I don't think she was dead.
Yeah. So if she's bleeding, and he had her crawl out of there, I think you'd have a DNA trail of something if she was doing it that way. Because I think any other bodily fluids coming off of her was being absorbed by him, whatever he was wearing. So to cover that his tracks unintentionally on the way out. It's a whole thing's crazy.
Another week and more questions than answers, really, on this. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in, and we'll continue that part of the conversation right there. Let's go over to another big case we've been following. For months, almost everything about the case against a teenager accused of killing Anna Kempner on the Carnival ship was locked away, a sealed file, a juvenile proceeding. Very little anyone outside that courtroom could actually see. Then the seal came off, a detention hearing transcript unsealed, and all at once the government's evidence is out in the open. Footage tracking his movements step by step, a phone found smashed in a trash bin, DNA testing, an autopsy, and there's a turn that has people fired up even with all of it laid out. Even now that he's charged as an adult and facing life, a judge let him walk out and stay free until trial, even with more evidence against him than ever before. Oh, and by the way, there's minors apparently at the house where he's staying, and the judge is still like, I need to talk to somebody about this. Is this appropriate? I don't know. So how much is this evidence really worth? And how does a case like this really get built? Joining me to discuss, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent, and Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. There's a lot to get to in this new drop of information that has come out on this case. Not just the fact that his apparently it looks like he smashed her phone and dropped it into a garbage can. But there's also a bigger piece to this equation that I think ties a lot of it together, in my opinion, in terms of motive. It's also been revealed that she had an encounter, a relationship, if you will, with a consensual one, with another gentleman on the ship prior to being violated by her stepbrother. And so they looked into him. They checked his DNA, too, to make sure that, and he's checked out. He had nothing to do with this, it looks like, obviously. But I am wondering when we're trying to go to what made this 16-year-old, you know, predator in actual real life, snap the way he did. And I'm thinking that might be the answer right there. Jealousy, anger, rage. It would explain all of it, quite honestly. He discovered she was with someone that wasn't him, and she was never going to be with him to begin with. But I'm wondering, does that answer our question of what put this nutcase over the edge?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I'll tell you what, there's just, you never want to say the word always. Let's go with 99%.
Yeah.
See what Robin says. But there's always a proximal event. There's always a proximal event. Yeah. You're going, whether it's the Crumbly case, what made him snap. I mean, his dog died. His best friend moved away. Those are the proximal events that moved him. In this case, jealousy, rage, all of that, I think, pushed him over the brink. There's always the last, you know, little bit of push that somebody gets that wants to do this anyway. And then they're really pissed off and they go through with it. That's what I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially with someone like this, I can imagine you have a degree, and that's of the accused, Timothy, of fantasization going on about in the anticipation. Oh, finally going on a cruise. They're putting her in my room, and you have this buildup in your mind of what you expect it to be. And then you find out she's with someone else on that cruise in which you had that. And that, like Jen said, it's a pinnacle event, or, you know, triggering event for me. And that was because he was on an arc. He was definitely arcing on this behaviors towards her. And it's when that arc is escalating up and up and up, and then you have that kind of fantasy coming in because your parents put you in the same room with her. And I know people yesterday were commenting on, well, they had to put her with her, them with her, because she's the adult. And yeah, but you can always not stay in that room. But either way, that my conjecture is that kid was fantasizing that I finally have her to myself. We're in the same room together. I'll kick the little brother out, and we'll have this romantic, whatever was creepy crap was going through his head. And then he finds out she's with someone else, and he snapped.
When I read that, that was my, like, oh, that explains everything.
There's always something, you know, because when you see these things, past is prologue, not just with individuals, but with cases. That, you know, first time you see anything, in most cases, like, all right, who's got the life insurance policy? Where's the jilted lover? Where's the child custody issues? Where's the fantasization from some nutter that, you know, has, you know, targeting someone in their lives that's escalating? And there's always an event that puts them over that edge. All you got to do is look for it.
Let me ask you this. I mean, this is a very, I mean, there's plenty of crazy, horrible adults that think this way too, but it is a very immature, very adolescent way of thinking, very reactionary, very non, you know, grown up brain that processes thoughts like this. And he's being tried as an adult. And he chose that path. Should he be being tried as an adult? I mean, I hope they lock him away and throw away the key. People like this, even if you're 16 and you do some shit like this, there's no saving you. But at the same point, I don't know. This is a very juvenile way of thinking. He's doing a very childish, they're very adult, horrible things. They're not adult. They're monstrous. They're predator like is what they are. But. Again, if we try to understand the way of thinking and the way he's operating here, this doesn't sound like an adult. This sounds like a kid. a kid that has body parts that are functioning like an adult and a brain that's functioning like a predator. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Jen?
Well, you know, this case was one of these from the minute this happened. I was on it. Why? Because I worked in the Virgin Islands, and one of the cases I had when I was there was a homicide on the cruise ship. And so it was just all kind of brought all that back. I just was on this case. And when I found out it was a juvenile, there, as I had explained for probably the past 9 months or so, there's the Juvenile Delinquency Act. And the only reason I'm familiar with that is working gangs, where you have all these juveniles. And the federal system does not charge juveniles. There's a couple of very rare cases on Indian reservations. That's it. So you knew one of two things was going to happen in the juvenile delinquency court proceeding. And that was either A, they had to move him up to an adult, which only happens in the absolute most egregious of violent cases, i.e. this case, or B, he's going to be turned over to the locals in Miami-Dade or Broward, whichever one it was. I can't remember what the court was. I thought it was Miami-Dade anyway. And they were going to handle it. And the Bureau and the AUSA's office decided, no, we're taking this one. This is absolutely too egregious not to take. So that's the reason that it's there. So I guess to your answer, a huge court proceeding took place to decide all of this with all sides weighing in, all the facts known. And a judge said, listen, we got to get this guy tried as an adult. So I defer to that decision. I'm not going to say, though, I was pretty surprised.
And I just researched, you know, potential upsides. Again, I'm going to try to channel my inner Bob Mata. And on this one, choice is unusual and for being defense driven. But so here's some upsides by waiving his right to be tried as a juvenile, right to a jury trial under this, and also guarantees more of a right or more opportunities for plea deals as well. Broader constitutional protections as an adult, potential for faster resolution and better plea deals, strategic sentencing and public perception factors is what they're saying on this. But the downside is sentencing guidelines are much higher as an adult than as a juvenile. So they're really rolling the dice on it. But my guess, you know, and this is what both Eric and Bob say all the time, is I think it increases their ability to get a plea deal if this evidence is so stacked against them. And because remember, this is, I know we haven't talked about the parents yet. I hope I'm not jumping ahead on our topics on that, Tony. But remember, it looks like the parents don't want to be dragged into this whatsoever. They've distanced themselves from them. And so if you don't want to be involved, you don't want, and you're trying to distance your crazy family from the craziness of this accused homicidal maniac, the first thing you want to do is have him plead out. And so if this increases the ability to plead out quicker, it makes sense.
That's kind of how I've been reading it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I said a long way. It's like, I took a long word for you to say the same thing.
No, sorry. I mean, I agree. I mean, I feel like that kind of feels like where, I don't know. I mean, everybody's got their motivating, but I don't know. I mean, it's been a weird thing because obviously there was signs that home life wasn't great. There was warning signs there that seemed to have been ignored. At least that's my conjecture. And I think the conjecture of a lot of people, the parents had not been charged with anything. I'm not saying they had anything to do with the murder or anything like that, but you go, oh, what was the recipe that made this kid? And now this kid acted out, and despite the warnings, now nobody wants to be responsible for not seeing the warning signs. It's kind of what I'm saying. And maybe that's just it at the end of the day. There's nothing to prosecute her. There's nothing criminal that went on with the parents other than just irresponsible parenting, maybe. I don't know. Or just not being aware, not being as in tune with your kids as you should be. That's about 95% of parents.
Avoiding the crumbs.
So, you know, I think it's a hard thing to litigate there, but it's just, it's another observation where you go, well, this could have been prevented. He walked around apparently after the fact with her cell phone, busted it, dumped it into a garbage can on the cruise ship. Somebody who worked on the cruise ship found it. It had been pinging the system's Wi-Fi the whole time, so it showed exactly where it was. When you show that, when we see here a sign of a cover-up, even more than the life jackets that were jammed on top of her body underneath the bed, even more than him blocking his brother from getting into the room, even more than him walking by the scene as everybody's standing around this door and they realize it's a crime scene. What's happened in this room? And he just casually takes, you know, a jaunt pass so he can get to the lunchtime buffet. Who knows where he was going? But the fact that we see this this attempted cover up that's going on beyond all of that. Is that what does that tell us about the case in terms of helping or hurting his defense? I mean, it certainly shows that there was a consciousness of what he did in the initial lines of "I have no memory, no recollection of what happened," kind of goes out the window now that we see he went and tried to hide her cellular device after the fact.
Totally agree. Consciousness of guilt. That's what it shows here. And it shows a cover up. It shows it's baloney. He didn't know what he did. And it shows that he knew what he did was wrong. Mm-hmm. So you add that all together. No, it doesn't help the case. Again, he's going to be tried as an adult, but will, like we saw in the detention here, age be sort of in the back of the mind and at least be mentioned by the judge. Now, remember, it'll be a different judge. There's a U.S. magistrate judge, which is the first step in any federal case. They handle the detention hearings, probable cause hearings if they occur, and bond hearings. Then after that, it will be remanded to a district judge that will actually decide the case. Let's hope we don't get one as liberal. I mean, it's egregious that somebody who is being tried as an adult who has committed a RAPE and a murder, allegedly, is walking. You would never see that happen. I am stunned at the decision. Wow. And I knew he went by, there's only two, a lot of people were trying to understand this. There's only two things that can be considered by a judge. Is he a flight risk and is he a danger to the community? And the judge basically said, well, look, this whole time he's been out on bond, before this, he hasn't done anything wrong. Bzz, that is also a very, very bad answer, in my opinion, because what happens is as court continues, as he figures out he's going to go to prison for many, many years, that's when an event will happen and he's going to be out.
Yeah. So the desperation kicks in. It's not there yet.
This whole thing's helped. Everything's happening is helping the parents. Everything. So imagine this, my conjecture hat, you know, playing reverse in optics. So you put him in jail in a general population. What's a 16-year-old going to do to people that they can't control? And then those people. And so those people now are going to be called on the witness stand. They're going to be called to testify. Meanwhile, if he's hiding out in his uncle's house, who's he talking to?
Yeah,
I think
that's a good point.
I think this entire thing is just covering for the parents.
There's a lot of steering that's going on.
All the adults in this house, 100%. And so as important as he is, because he's the one that took all the execution of this, he's now become a pawn of all the adults in this thing, I think, covering their asses as well.
Everybody that doesn't want to account for their poor behavior. And again, I'm not saying that was even criminal behavior of the parents or anything like that, but
they're
the bad behavior,
it's
accountability that everyone's hiding from. The accountability of this being their kid, of not being responsible enough to see the red flags when they were warned about it, allegedly. I mean, all that. I mean, granted, this is all our conjecture. This is all our opinion, yada, yada, yada. But it all seems to be stacking that way without a doubt. I mean, and they don't have, and there's only certain levers that are able to be controlled by them. But at the same point, he is 16. One more thing on this. No danger to the public. It was a minor that he is a minor. But the thing is, he's staying, apparently, that we've learned now. It's not just with the uncle that has the landscaping business that we all thought, okay, well, I guess, you know, the uncle all by himself with the landscape. No, it's an uncle with two kids in the house. And that's part of the equation now, too. And the judge is still like, I don't know. What could possibly go wrong here? Gee, I wonder.
To be his fetish, and that seemed to be his fetish, as one of our great commentators in the chat was saying. His fetish is this. And to Jen's point earlier, too, I looked up the stat yesterday. The probability of Judge letting someone like this out on and to roam free after their charge like this, I think it's like 15% of the time is the only time it happens. I mean, extremely low.
I mean, are people looking at the – and I'm wondering how – let me ask you this one, Jen, and we'll go to our next topic then. He looks like a child. I mean, you've seen the pictures of him. He looks like a kid. How much is that – I mean, how do you think that'll affect the jury on this if it doesn't get pled out?
It's going to affect the jury because you're going to have moms in there that have issues with their kids that can't control their boys or girls, whatever it may be, but particularly boy in this case because he's a boy, and you're going to have them thinking about, oh my gosh, you know, and you're going to have empathy, I think, set in. I mean, if I'm the defense attorney, I want an entire panel of women.
Moms,
I want moms, I want young women, I want grandmas, I want the whole gamut, and I don't want to see one guy. No. That won't happen, but that's what you're going to want because they're going to have, they're going to look over, believe me, they're going to have him dressed up like a Pee Wee Herman in terms of like looking like young and
sitting on Sherry
and looking completely oblivious like he always does. I mean, you're right. He's a compelling figure for sympathy if you didn't know exactly what he did. And that's why I'm agreeing with you, Jen. I think it's in his best interest to have a jury trial. But my bet is it's going to get pled out.
I wouldn't doubt it. I wouldn't doubt it at all. The evidence is just so strong, and they're going to fall on the sympathy of a judge that might say, listen, this kid needs another chance.
And you know what? So far, judges have been sympathetic towards him. So, yeah, why not, right?
Little Timmy wants to drive the boat. your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Okay, we're going to play pretend for a moment now with Alec Murdaugh. All right. Let's say the quiet part out loud. We all know this. Alec Murdaugh's murder conviction is gone, overturned by the state Supreme Court, and not because anyone called him innocent. He's an admitted thief with decades of federal time left, and that stands. It fell because a court clerk leaned into the jury, and because the judge let his financial mess swallow the actual murder question. So strip all that away, and let's look at what's left here. We got two people shot at the kennels. Two different guns, neither ever having the guns found. No blood on the man the state pointed at for 6 weeks. So today, a thought experiment. If it's not Alec, who is it? Got Jennifer Coffendaffer with us and Robin Dreek, both retired FBI special agents. Let's take Murdaugh's name out of this. And I know, and we all probably agree Alec did this. But if he didn't, and they're going to dig in deeper, if we were to look at this from another perspective, because there are interesting lanes here that I still wonder about to this day of could there have been other people involved? Let's start out cold here. Forget the name Murdaugh. It's not on the board. Two bodies are set at the dog kennels deep on a rural hunting property with fresh eyes and no suspect in your head. Where does that scene point you first, Jen, if you're pulling up as a member of law enforcement and Alec is right there, standing there, hey, hi, how are you? In his white shirt, what do you do? What are you looking for?
Oh, I have to answer. Can I defer this to a defense attorney? You know what? I mean, there's just nothing that makes sense. In other words, okay, some of the theories out right there, right?
Yeah.
It's opioid supplier.
Okay.
So opioid supplier is going to come into the deep part of his property at the dog kennel and just decide to blow the head off of his son. You can bleep that out. That's what happened. And then with his wife crawling around on the ground, hunt her with a different gun. And then, oh, by the way, use the ammunition that is theirs. And oh, by the way, the Murdaugh guns are missing. No, if you're a person outside, you're going to bring your own weaponry to commit the crime? And how is that going to help you taking out, you know, the family of for drug debt? So that's just ridiculous. Okay, now the other one is revenge. Is it revenge because Mallory died in this horrible boating accident that Papa did? If that's it, and you're the family or a loved one or just a wackadoodle that's pissed off about Mallory Beach being dead, then you're going to do that on Paul. You're going to figure out a time where Paul, who's absolutely out of control, it's easy to find him by himself drinking somewhere. That's where you're going to take him out. You're not going to go on his property down to the kennel and then also kill the mom. So I just am at a loss of, and then, okay, Buster, right? Some people still say Buster.
I haven't heard that one.
I have, but it's ridiculous because he has a rock solid alibi about like 3.5 hours away with his girlfriend. That's not going to play either.
Yeah.
So it doesn't make any sense that it's anyone other than somebody in that proximity and the whatever puts him there, the Snapchat.
Yeah. Yeah, and I agree too. Alex is the one that really fits everything on this one. But to your conjecture and to your thought experiment, Tony, so remove him from this as a suspect, even though you need this other element that I'd be looking at too. It's like, all right, because all these other things don't really flesh out, but there's a lot of 1 degrees of separation from potential impact of the financial crimes he inflicted on others. So I'd probably be looking at revenge motives from people associated with those that were impacted majorly financially that would want retribution in some way. And the next thing you start looking at leakage along the way, stalking behaviors, you know, I'd be looking for arcs of escalation that would go in this area from people that might've been impacted by his financial crimes that he inflicted on others if I wasn't looking at him first.
Robin wins the game show again.
And congratulations, you get to go home with some delicious Rice-A-Roni, the San Francisco treat.
Yes.
A year's supply of it, Jen, just for you. Rice-A-Roni. You pull Alex out and you got to put somebody in. If we're playing that thought experiment, someone with a reason to drive onto that land and kill a wife and her son. Paul was facing charges over the boat crash that killed the Mallory Beach and the lawsuits and the grudges they were piling up. If there was an outsider outside of any of this, if we had to look outside of the boat crash, if we had to look outside of his financial crimes, the only area that makes no sense to me is the sheer dollar amount of money that Alec Murdaugh was spending on his opioid addiction.
I looked it up too.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Let me finish this thought, you can debunk it. Is the sheer amount? I mean, from everything I've understood, is like this could kill a zoo. Like this is not one man's opioid addiction, unless he's like hoarding opioids somewhere for fun, and it's just another addiction of his is collecting drugs. I don't know, but other than that, what are you doing with all these things? Are you getting that dramatically ripped off on the drugs you're buying? Or is there something else going on here that none of us are quite aware of or quite understand that go beyond Alec Murdaugh just sourcing opioids for himself? Is there a greater crime or another crime that's taking place here in Murdaughville that nobody is, I guess, truly aware of yet, or that hasn't been brought to the forefront that would somehow intersect with this murder that would give us more sensibility or more sense as to why this would have taken place? Robin, how am I wrong?
Well, I didn't say you're wrong. So when we did this thought experiment a couple weeks ago, I actually did a deeper dive on opioids in that area, drug traffic in that area, airport trafficking in that area, and actually looking at what can someone function on that amount every day. So here's what I found out. He testified under oath that he was taking up to 60 oxycodone, 30 milligram pills a day. That equals roughly 420 pills per week, or 1,800 milligrams of oxycodone daily. Street value for that pill typically is $20 to $40 for each pill, and an average of $30 per pill, 420, comes out to $12,600 per week. The $50,000 per week figure, is buying significantly more than that. But it is physically possible for him to actually still function on that many pills a day, because what happens is you get a tolerance for that level, and it doesn't start. It has a massive effect on your body, but it doesn't affect your day-to-day operation. He just became extremely tolerant of it. And I think the number that they came up with on this when I did the research, it didn't come out to 50,000. It came out to roughly like 36,000 to 44,000. And then with, just inflating things.
So when you do conjecture, it's like you see a 44 number. It's like it's almost 50,000 worth.
Yeah.
I can see how it gets conflated over time.
It is very plausible that is actually accurate. Even though it didn't sound accurate to me when I first heard it, yeah. I deep dove on it.
But did anybody test Alec Murdaugh to see if he was actually taking that many drugs?
That's a good question.
I mean, I think there would be a toxicology that would show that of some way, shape, or form to actually show, yes, in fact, he is taking that many drugs, or is that just his fucking story that he's telling people?
Or detox looks like snot coming out of your nose in trial.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just wondering if that is part of the story. I mean, Jen, do you think there's more to the drug story here, or is that just another piece of noise or another conspiracy theory? I hesitate to even call it conspiracy theory because it feels like something different than this. Anyway, what's your thoughts? Do you think there's more to the drug story on Alec?
It's this shameful and pathetically predictable excuse for why he committed the crimes he committed.
Yes.
Why didn't it be better? So he has to have this inflated amount that is not proven in anything that is factually concrete. That's just his numbers he threw out. So while they might be achievable, it was, like I said, pathetically predictable that he would try to say something like that.
And also, and to that, 100% agree. The fact, because part of us looking at it was he then reselling it? Was this drug dealers are coming to get their money? No, actually. So even if his numbers were accurate, they were consumable entirely by him, and he wasn't necessarily dealing, as we were going down that conjecture road, as possible theories as well. So yeah, Jen, I completely agree.
Give me an idea here, guys, from an investigative standpoint, with this thing going back to trial. Obviously, the attorneys of Murdaugh, Harpootalan, and Griffin have said they are going to be investigating it further, probably with their own PIs and such. But does this bring SLED back into the picture at all, or the FBI, or anybody to further investigate the case any deeper to counter anything that may be coming at the direction of the prosecution here? Does this further the murder investigation from SLED's perspective?
Absolutely. It will. And I would look for Griffin and Harpootalan, I say that right, to actually come up with a third party type theory. I don't know if the court will allow it, because if you don't have evidence of it, you can't allow it. But that's what I'm looking for. They're going to come up with something, and then SLED will get involved to investigate to see if there's any truth.
And talking about SLED, what do you think about SLED's conduct during this entire thing? Because they had, I looked this up last time we were talking about this too, Jen, they have a huge amount of resources, and they had a lot of reps. In other words, the amount of investigations they conduct per year in South Carolina is pretty substantial. And it's broken down, I think it's four districts they have, but each one of them had a lot of experience apparently doing this. Do you think they're on or off with how they conducted the investigation? How do you think it's going to impact the second investigation? Well, the second trial.
You know, overall, I think they did a pretty decent job. I really do. But there's always going to be mistakes made, because everyone on SLED, just like everybody in the FBI, nobody is perfect. But are there any large enough holes or mistakes they made to affect? I don't know. I mean, if they're smart, the defense attorneys, they will try to go after the investigation harder than they did before. I would be looking under every stone as to what they did wrong and try to run it like Alan Jackson would run it.
Mm-hmm. It makes you wonder if they're going to go for a third party. Are they going to name a name? Are they going to try and go down there? Is it going to be a mystery and just kind of out there in the ether? Do you think they have? I mean, the one that comes to my mind that has been kind of used as the scapegoat 50 different times, and no way am I saying he had anything to do with this, is the Cousinetti character. But I am wondering if we're going to see somebody thrown under the bus here in an effort to protect or preserve Alec Murtaugh's flimsy reputation or whatever may be left of it.
A lot of it will depend on how much money Alec still has squirreled away to pay these guys and how they want to win. What they should be doing is they should be setting up mock trials and hiring individuals to be these juries and run by two or three different scenarios and see how that works in terms of what wins. Does it win just to basically indict and just make the investigation look horrible? Is it better to blame Eddie? Is it better to play they should set up those. That's what I would do if I had all the money, and set them up and see which one wins.
Yeah, good point.
If you were anybody in the world of Alec Murtaugh right now, and if you were Cousin Eddie or you were anybody that may have more information about Alec Murtaugh that you have not shared at this moment in time, would now be the opportune time to do so?
It's the opportune time, but you know, I tell you, as an investigator for me, and I know we've talked a little bit about this, Robin and I have, but look, when people come in this late, after years and everything, you just have to, it's difficult to fully consider. I'm not saying that stuff like that won't happen and it won't be used, but hopefully the jury has on their wait a minute goggles, because a lot of times it's not valid information.
Yeah, a lot of times, man, we dealt with this a lot. When I worked in the RA here, the resident agency, you know, my main focus is always counterintelligence stuff. But inevitably, when you're working smaller offices, you do a lot of bleed over. And I would have some public corruption stuff. And man, people love going at each other in the areas of election fraud and public corruption, stuff like that. My first response always is, hey, man, that sounds really great. Show me. Show me the email, show me the text, show me something, because your recollection and your memory is a fantastic thing, but I can't bring that anywhere. Show me. So at this point, if someone has something else, show me.
Be interesting to see if anything is shown from anybody in the world of the Murtaughs. Fascinating new directions here with all of these cases. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in. Be sure to check out Jen's podcast, Break the Case, with Jennifer Coffendaffer, wherever you get podcasts, and also on YouTube. Just search it there, press subscribe, and of course Robin's latest book, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get books, and also available on audiobook right now. Go and check it out. Until next time, for Jen, for Robin, and for Todd, I am Tony. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and I have discovered a fun new escape from the daily grind, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has hundreds of social casino-style games and it's all free to play anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. So get to chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to chumbacasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to chumbacasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to chumbacasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T&Cs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 30% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Drew McIntyre here from WWE. Wielding the Claymore can be a life of chaos. When I'm not dominating in the ring, Chumba Casino is how this warrior takes a wee break. With hundreds of online social games and new weekly releases, there's always something fresh to try. And those daily boosts, next level. Even my free time feels like Valhalla. So when life feels like a battle, kick up your feet, have some fun, and let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.